It really is use it or lose it with your brain. So your brain, as I said a couple of times now, is this really high energy organ. It uses about 25% of all the oxygen and nutrients that are circulating in your body at any one time. And it can't afford to waste energy on cells that aren't being used. So if you're not using your brain through social connection or through challenging yourself, those brain cells will die off, or they'll be even pruned away through a process called apoptosis. So your brain will shrink.
So I've read a bit of your stuff and trying to understand all this neuroscientist things, and I know you get this all the time. People are like, what the hell, you know?
It's
kind of overwhelming. So I want you to kind of start off on, somebody might have clicked on this podcast because they're like, oh, neuroscientist, very, you know, fancy, like it sounds very in-depth. Tell me essentially what a neuroscientist is or what a neuroscientist does.
Yeah, so neuroscientists come in lots of shapes and sizes, really. So it's kind of this umbrella term, and it really just means neuroscience is the study of the brain. And so we're interested in how the brain works, you know, and what it does and what happens, you know, if something goes wrong with the brain. But the reason why it's this motley crew of people is that you can look at the brain from so many different levels. So most of the people who are neuroscientists are something else before that. So I'm a psychologist and a neuroscientist. So I'm a psychologist who has an interest in how the brain works and how that relates to our behavior and our emotions and our cognitive function, our mental capacities, you know, like thinking and memory and decision making, that sort of thing. But you could have a physiologist or an immunologist or a chemist, and they're looking at the brain, we'll say, from the molecular level or the chemistry level. You know, I'm interested in all those things, how they're happening. So I will read and understand their work as well, but my end of interest is how that impacts on human behavior, whereas someone else's end of interest might be to find a mechanism to deliver a drug through, you know, to treat pain, we'll say, or something like that. So we have an Institute of Neuroscience in Trinity College, and that's people from lots of disciplines, so that kind of makes it exciting.
Yeah,
plus the brain is fascinating. You know, it's kind of the final frontier of the human body. You know, we've learned a lot about it in the last 30 years or so because of advances in technology. So what we call imaging technology, so that would be MRI scans, but we have now functional MRI scans. So you can look at the brain while someone, for example, is carrying out a memory task, and you have EEGs and all technology that has allowed us look inside the functioning brain. And that's kind of allowed us understand the brain a bit better, but there's still so much we don't know about it.
So there's so much that we so is there things unexplained in neuroscience that there's human behavior and you don't know necessarily where it comes from? Like there's still ongoing
stuff.
I'm sure.
Yeah, we're still trying to understand stuff. I mean, we've good ideas around, you know, certain things, and we know about certain things, you know, how they work, or you might know broadly speaking how things work. And we know what parts of the brain are involved in different things, because you'd be able to see, for example, you know, that they would light up while you're doing a particular task. And that just means, when we say light up, you know, when you're looking at a functional MRI scanner, you know, an area of the brain, you know, it'll light up on your map on your computer. Do you know that kind of way? So you can see what brain is, what area is actually active. And that's done, like, it's physicists who actually, you know, develop all that sort of technology. And it's you know, it's based on the movement of molecules in the brain and all that sort of complicated stuff. Some of that I don't really understand. But I mean, your brain communicates. Your brain cells communicate with each other and with the cells in the rest of your body by electrical and chemical signals. So that's kind of, you know, pretty fascinating. And that's how we can look at some of the activity in the brain. So like you can get an ECG for your heart, an electrocardiogram. You can get an EEG for your brain, which is an electroencephalogram. So it basically measuring the electrical activity in your brain. So you can see what areas are active while you're doing certain tasks.
So can you give me an example of a task like that and what kind of messages would be going on in the brain? Like maybe something very simple. Just so people would understand.
So I could tell you, like, so your brain is, oh gosh, it's fascinating. I mean, you know, it's literally involved in every single thing that you do. Okay. There isn't one thing that you can do without your brain. So if I was to give you, even when your brain is asleep, it's working. When you're asleep, your brain is working. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'll use that as an example because it's a nice sort of easy to understand one. So when you're just getting on with your life every day, like we are now, we're talking and you're taking in information. And, you know, if you go to work and you learn some new things, or you're walking along the street and you notice something new or whatever, that information is coming into your brain, okay, through your various senses. And it sort of goes into like a temporary repository, a temporary storage area. And I don't like to say that very much because we don't have boxes in our brain. You know, it really is
filing cabinets.
Yeah, we don't have that. That kind of used to be used to explain how memory works, but it really isn't like that. It's holding a memory trace through patterns of electrical activity. But anyway, that information comes in and it's sort of held in a part of your brain called the hippocampus, which is shaped like a seahorse. Temporarily, right, during the day. And that hippocampus has really limited space. So when you go to sleep at night, it's got to clear out that information so it can take in new information the next day. So when you go to sleep at night, in the early part of the night, we see electrical activity from that hippocampus going to the frontal lobes, the front part of your brain, you know, just behind your forehead, that area. And so what we think is happening there is the front part of your brain is involved in decision making. And so we think the information that's taken in during the day is sent there to be filtered. What do I need to keep and what can I discard? Because you can't remember everything that you've taken in. So there's like this filtering activity happens in the early part of the night. Then we see a change in the type of electrical activity and it becomes much more diffuse. So spread across networks in your brain. And that's actually that new information being consolidated as memories in traces, in networks across your brain, because different parts of your brain are involved in different activities. So smell would be in one part of your brain and language in another and vision in another. So, you know, there's lots of areas and that kind of consolidates memory. And then in the later part of the night, which I would tend to think of as early morning, when you have more REM sleep, which is your dream sleep, that new information that has come in to be sort of embedded in the brain as new memories is then linked with your previous memories, your previous knowledge, your previous life experience. And you see a different activity during REM sleep. And that kind of explains why you have those mad dreams. You know, the ones where you something from today is in your dream, but it's mixed with something from when you were a kid or something with your parents and it's all mixed up. Well, that's what's happening. Your brain is making connections. Your brain loves patterns. So it's connecting that information. And that's why if you go to sleep and a good night's sleep, you know that old, I love this, you know, when old wives' tales, kind of when neuroscience sort of gives the explanation why they happen. You know the way people say sleep on a problem or sleep on it and you might be able to figure it out in the morning. You'll often wake up after a good night's sleep and you've solved the problem and it's your brain has solved the problem. You've put the information in and then it's kind of connected it with previous information and kind of comes up with the solution for you. So that's why sleep is critical for all of us. But that's kind of, you know, an explanation about how memories are formed and how we get insight and creativity. And interestingly, actually, if you daydream, so if you're awake, you see a lot of activity in your brain in different areas when you're engaged in a task, right? A very specifically task-focused activity, like cooking the dinner or something like that.
Yeah.
But if you just chill and relax and maybe just let your mind wander, you know, you're just not engaged in anything in particular, you're sort of daydreaming, there's a complete change in the type of electrical activity in your brain. And actually, some areas of your brain become more active, surprisingly. And that really is what we consider where creativity and insight lies. So your brain is kind of just working through stuff, you know, and figuring stuff out. So it's kind of important to allow that kind of time in your day as well, because, you know, sometimes we don't give our brain enough credit, and we're consciously always trying to figure things out. And we think that we, you know, whatever that is, you know, our sense of self feels that it's really got to work very hard at doing stuff and figuring stuff out.
Whereas actually
whereas actually sometimes it's good to just let the information come in, ask a clear question, and I call it marinating. Let that information marinate in your brain, and your brain might, you know, find interesting angles and patterns that you may never have thought of. So it's kind of a balance. It's not all of one and none of the other, but kind of a balance to allow time, you know. And they're those eureka moments. Do you know the way sometimes you could just be pushing a trolley through a supermarket and you'll go, oh, that's how I'll do that.
Yeah, because you know? Because I was having a conversation with I can't remember who it was, but we were saying, I emailed my boss on a Sunday night because I got an idea. And we had this conversation about, you know, when your brain relaxes over the weekend, these ideas come in. And her boss was like, why are you working on a Sunday night? And she's like, I wasn't working. It just came to me, you know. Yes. So that explains how those ideas
that
come.
Is exactly it.
Yeah.
Chilled out over the weekend, working really hard all week, trying to wrestle. So actually, I often say to people, you know, if I give talks, and depending on the particular profession of the people I might be talking to, you know, a lot of people are under a lot of stress, working very late into the night, trying to find solutions. To be honest, I'd say, look, put it aside, collect all the information you need, put the question in there, put it aside, do something relaxing, get a good night's sleep, and you wake up in the morning. And, you know, it might take more than one sleep, you know, but, you know, it will come. Trust your brain. Your brain has a lifetime of experience in there. And you just kind of have to put the information there and kind of let it bubble up to the surface, you know, or prompt your brain to do things, you know. But one thing you do have to do to keep your brain sharp, to keep it healthy, to keep it able to do those kind of things, is you have to keep challenging your brain. You have to keep learning new things. And you're just coming to that age, Stephanie, where the brain starts to shrink and get smaller, and you start to lose brain cells. Well, from the age of 30, it starts to shrink. But the good news is that you can actually help to maintain your brain volume. Mm. And as a female, it's the one part of the body that you want to be bigger.
Yes. And so it's a good segue in, because one of the questions I had put down for you is about memory, because talking about, you know, sitting on information, or, hey, I'll think about that another time, or things popping up. I find personally I have an awful memory for as long as I can remember, and I know how to manage it and things like that. So how does our memory work? You put an information in, you might say, God, I'll think about that later, or some people have a super sharp memory. So how does the memory actually work?
Right. So that's interesting. I have a little animation on that too. I must send you some links to it that explain how, because I make little animations to explain some of the science that I do. But so that's interesting. So the thing is, we talk about memory as if it's a single thing, you know, my memory, but it's not. You have lots of different types of memory, and they work in different ways. So, and you have, oh gosh. So this is, you have, episodic memory, that's what we call one thing. And that's, it's kind of a big word that just comes from episodes. So that's memory for episodes in your life, you know, for events, for things that happen. And then you have another type of memory called semantic memory. And that's memories for facts, knowledge, information. You know, Trump is the president of the United States. Not for long, we hope. Anyway. And that's memory for facts. But then you have procedural memory. So that's how you physically do stuff. So like riding a bicycle.
This is so fascinating.
Putting your makeup on, you know, so that sort of physical memory. And then you have, we'll say, prospective memory is another type of memory. And what that is remembering to do something in the future. So you and I had to use our prospective memory to remember to show up today for this podcast. Do you know? It's remembering to do something in the future. And then you have, that's sort of how we categorize types of memories. But then you have, how do you retrieve a memory? You know, so there's recall, sort of full recall, where you can just remember the thing, you know. But then you have recognition memory. So you mightn't be able to actually freely recall something, but if you saw something, say there's a new type of car out or whatever, when you see it, you realize, oh yeah, that's what that is. Do you know what I mean? You recognize it, but you may not freely recall the thing. And then we have implicit memory and explicit memory. So, that explicit memory is sometimes called declarative memory. So implicit memory are things that, as the word sort of says, that we implicitly remember. We don't consciously make an effort to remember it. Do you know what I mean?
It's
there. And explicit memory or declarative memory is, as the name suggests, memories that we can declare, you know, that we can say or speak about. Then we have, you know, we have short-term memory. Yeah, we have working memory. So working memory would be if you go to the supermarket, we'll say, and you only have $20, you're going around the shop and you buy four items and you go, God, I hope I have enough. And you go, well, that's $1.99 and that's five. So that's working memory. So you've got to keep five things in your head, like juggling a ball, you know, while you then add the information. Or working memory could also be, you know, trying to remember someone's phone number till you get somewhere where you can write it down or type it into your phone. Memory is, you know, it's pretty complex. So you can be really good at certain aspects of memory and other aspects, you know, not so good. But memory can be trained. One thing that's interesting about memory is, so you sort of have then, if you talk about that, sort of, I've sort of talked about types of memory, but if you think about the process of memory, I described some of it, you know, what happens when we sleep, but there's various stages that memory goes through. So actually, attention is really the first step in the memory making process. So if you say, for example, you know, frequently lose your keys or glasses or whatever, you know.
Sounds like me.
It sounds like a lot of people. So probably if you're a bit like me, well, when I used to have a life outside my home, but, you know, I'd come home and, you know, you might come in the door and, I sort of say to my husband, you know, God, that fella just cut me off in the traffic, you know, or wait till I tell you what happened today. Or I might be kicking my shoes off at the same time because my feet are killing me in the high heels. And then I go over to the fridge to see what's for dinner. And somewhere in that whole process, I put my keys down. Okay. Haven't paid any attention to where I put my keys. So that's the first step. If you haven't paid any attention to where you put them, you can't go to the next step, which is encoding a memory. And then if you haven't encoded a memory, you can't consolidate it at nighttime when you go to sleep, that process that I was talking about. And then if you don't consolidate a memory, you have no chance of retrieving it the next day. So paying attention, so you can really solve that losing key issue. What I've done is I'm a huge IKEA fan. I got one of those, those units that you can put them on a wall, and there's drawers for shoes, these kind of pull out things for shoes, and then the top drawers for keys and stuff. So I put one of those in, and the minute I come in the door, my keys go in there. And so I never have to look for my keys. That's where they go. And I just trained, you can train a new habit like that within about 3 weeks. You just have to actively think about doing it for the first few weeks, and then it will become automatic. It will become a habit, and you won't have to think about it. A different part of your brain, a sort of a non-cognitive part of your brain, non-thinking part of your brain, will just automate that activity for you. But yeah, attention, and then the memory is encoded, and then the memory is consolidated. Then you can retrieve it. And the more you retrieve it, so like studying for an exam, you know, you get it in there first. It's quite labile, you know, it's subject to interference, and other things might kind of, you know, superseded. So you've got to keep, if you want something to really stay, you've got to kind of repeat it and keep, I think I say in one of my animations or one of my websites, you've got to keep taking that memory out and polishing it every now and then, so that it gets embedded. But there's other really, really good tricks for remembering things. I think we go to school. When we're kids, if you look at a kid, a preschool kid, you know, a toddler, they explore the world using all of their senses. Things are going in their mouths, they're touching things, they're rolling over onto things, you know, they're making noise in a room. I bring a kid into an empty room and they'll straight away start making noises because of the echo in the room. So they explore the world with all of their senses, and that's how we learn. But then we go to school. And I don't know about you, but we had law of attraction for anyone who doesn't speak Irish. You know, you had to sit down at your desk with your arms folded and not move around. And actually, we used to be told to put our fingers in front, one finger in front of our lips as well, because that meant, you know, you're not supposed to talk either. So basically, then you go to school and the teacher implements all these things to control her group of children. So basically, then narrows the children's learning down to almost aural, you know, listening. And obviously they will have their vision as well, but it deprives the kids of all those other senses that actually enrich memory. So if you want to improve your memory, one really, really good way to do it is to engage most of your senses. So it's something maybe you do when you're out walking. You know, you might notice the smell of the trees or fresh cut grass or, a car, you know, diesel or whatever. But the more senses that you can engage around trying to remember something, the richer that memory is. Because remember I said your memory is consolidating, and we see that network across all the areas of your brain. So basically it means if you can't remember the words, if you can't get at it through your language center, you know, your sensory smells, your sense of smell might bring the memory back, or your sense of touch might bring it back. So
yeah, I find a lot of the time, well, this is maybe just specific to me, but I find sometimes I remember my feelings, how I felt about something, but I don't remember what it was. I remember the feelings around it, but I don't remember what it was.
Yes. So that actually is another type of memory that I didn't mention. So you have emotional memory. So yes, those memories, so emotions, emotional memories will stick.
Yeah.
Okay. And they'll sort of, in a way, they stick. Pretty much everything that we do or continue to do as human beings exists because it serves some purpose, some function. It's adaptive. You know, we have evolved, and remembering things with strong emotional context are important for us. Particularly if it's something negative, because your brain then maybe come aware and say, well, I don't want to experience that again. But also if it's positive, you know, I mean, like if you go to a party and you meet 10 different people, you know, you're going to remember the person you had a good laugh with more than any of the others. Do you know what I mean? You've had this full experience.
Yeah, so even subconscious energy that you might get off somebody, even if you didn't engage with them as much, you just kind of almost get a subconscious energy off them, and you always remember.
Well, yeah,
that
I don't know what it is. Yeah, sometimes you can kind of go, oh, I just didn't take to that person. You know, something felt off for you. Some people call that instinct. I mean, I think, you see, again, That feeling that we call that gut feeling, that's usually sort of our fear response. So that gut feeling is the release of adrenaline and, you know, in your gut. And that's released in situations of stress and fear. And I would say some people say always trust your gut. I would say, no, you need to engage your frontal lobes as well. And I think sometimes your brain, as I said, your brain loves patterns. And so it may be subconsciously registering a pattern about something, that behavior that sparks a little alarm in your brain related to something negative that happened in the past. Now, it might be relevant or it might be irrelevant, but you have the capacity as a human to explore that, you know, if you wish and kind of decide. I should explain as well, sort of in a way, how the brain evolved affects the way it's shaped and worked. So if you can visualize a brain, the stem part that kind of then connects to your spinal cord, there's sort of a little roundy thing on, you know, near that and the stem, and it's actually called your brain stem area, but it's also called the reptilian brain, and that's because it's the first part of the brain that evolved, and it carries out all of the really, really life, all of the functions that support life. It is responsible for things like your breathing, your heart rate, digestion, all those things that you actually don't have to consciously think about. You know, you don't have to consciously think about breathing. You don't have to consciously digest your food. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It happens. So that part of the brain looks after that. And that's why if that part is damaged, you know, you may end up in a coma or dead, you know, because it's the vital life-supporting activities. So then the next part of the brain to evolve is really deep in the middle, the center of your brain, like the core of an apple, you know, in there. And that is called your limbic system, but we also call it the emotional brain. And that's where parts of your brain like the amygdala live. And that the amygdala is your fear and emotional center. And that part of the brain is also connected then to the crinkly part, the crinkly outer bit. That's the most modern part of the brain. It was the last to evolve. And that's where all our functions like memory, attention, language, vision, all those things, motor movement, all those things take place there. But the very front part of that, underneath your forehead, your frontal lobes, that was the last part of the brain to evolve. And that's the part that really kind of helps us stand out as humans above other species, because it's kind of that, we call them higher order functions, but it really allows you to take information from all sorts of your environment, your brain, your senses, and kind of, you know, figure out the context and make decisions and organize stuff and plan things.
Yeah.
And inhibit your behavior, you know, and say, "Oh, don't behave that way in this situation," you know. But they're interlinked.
That's obviously not the only difference that makes us humans, though, in terms of brain.
No. It's not the only thing, but it is the thing that is more advanced.
So,
as I said, you want as big a brain as possible, but you also want, it's the one part of your body that it's good to have wrinkles as well. You want, the more crinkly, the more wrinkled your brain is, because that's, I kind of describe it in my book that part of your brain, that outer crinkly cortex, is like a lesson in IKEA style ingenuity, you know, because if you actually spread your brain out, you know, it would be like a rug on the floor, you know, it would be meters wide if you ironed it out, you know. But actually this crinkling in on itself allows you get more and more brain cells and brain connections, and the more the merrier, you know, the more the better. And that's actually why you do need to keep learning things, and I don't mean just academic learning, you know, I mean new experiences. You moving to New York is learning, do you know what I mean? And it's challenging yourself, because your brain has to learn about a whole new city, a whole new way of life, a whole new, you know, culture, really, in a sense. And so that's really brilliant for your brain. And every time you learn something new in that way, I mean, learning in that broad sense, your brain grows new connections. Yeah, that kind of really makes your brain, it would make it healthier, but it also makes it capable, you know, it optimizes its function.
I was just going to say it's a nice segue into, you know, brain health and how we can support that. Because you said, you know, muscle, or we can, you know, support memory and we can train our brain to do these things. So what can we do every day to really support our brain health?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I'm really passionate about.
I know it's a big question.
No, it's okay. And I'll do it relatively quickly. But I mean, the thing is, you know, we all brush our teeth every day.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a really good investment. And it's a long term investment. You start brushing your teeth when you're a tot. And you brush your teeth so that you get to hold on to your teeth for as long as possible. Like, it's a long term investment. And to minimize toothache and dental decay and all the rest. And it's a bit the same with your brain health. We know that there's things that you can do each and every day that will help you hold on to functions and optimize your brain function right throughout life. So the things that you can do, you might be surprised. One of the best things you can do for your brain health is to get physically active. Your brain is a really high energy organ, and it needs a really fit cardiovascular system. So another thing you can do is look after your heart health. What's good for your heart is good for your brain. And your brain depends on that cardiovascular system to deliver the oxygen and nutrients that it needs to function. Challenging your brain, I've mentioned already. Sleep is critical. I've also touched on some of the reasons for that. And, you know, so many of us are sleep deprived that the World Health Organization has declared a sleep loss epidemic. And the thing is,
wow.
Yeah, sleep is critical for your brain health for one of the reasons, as I said, the memory issue, but also during the day, your lymphatic system clears out metabolic waste, you know, toxic toxins during the day, but your brain isn't part of that lymphatic system. So it can only do a thorough clean of your brain at nighttime when you're asleep.
Okay.
So it's really important to clear, you know, it's a high energy organ, so it produces a huge amount of metabolic waste, and you need to sleep to clear that waste. If you don't, you'll wake up feeling groggy and you won't be able to think straight because you haven't kind of cleared out some of the chemicals that can only be cleared at nighttime. So prioritize sleep, between 7 and 9 hours sleep. For most adults between sort of 24 and 65, you really should be aiming for that and prioritizing it. Let me see. So what did I say? Yes, social engagement is critical for your brain. So staying socially connected, and that's even, you know, more of an issue and a challenge with, you know, this new world that we're living in post-pandemic or during the pandemic. Social engagement is a really complex cognitive function. So if you think about it, when you're talking to somebody, you're listening to what they're saying, you're interpreting what they're saying, you're trying to figure out whether what they're saying is true, is valid, is rubbish, you know, do you believe them or why are they saying it? While you're doing that, you are also trying to figure out how you might respond to that person's question. Oftenly, as you said, if you're at a party, you could be doing that while you're holding canapés and a drink, or, you know, putting your makeup on in the bathroom. You know, it's a really complex activity, which is really good for your brain. And the thing is, it really is use it or lose it with your brain. So your brain, as I said a couple of times now, is this really high energy organ. It uses about 25% of all the oxygen and nutrients that are circulating in your body at any one time. And it can't afford to waste energy on cells that aren't being used. So if you're not using your brain through social connection or through challenging yourself, those brain cells will die off, or they'll be even pruned away through a process called apoptosis. So your brain will shrink. And I think that's part of the way.
Forever, or is it reversible?
It is reversible. It is reversible. So that's it. Yeah, it's, you're never too old to start looking after your brain health, and you can start growing new brain cells.
So but if you're a hermit, you can come out.
start coming out, engaging. I think that's one of the reasons that the brain does start to shrink from about the age of 30, because if you think about it, tend to, by that age, we do, you know, up to our 30s, we do most of our learning and education, you know, whether that's informal school, college, university, or even if you start a new job, learning how to do that new job. And that kind of tapers off afterwards. Similarly, a lot of people play sports, run around when they're kids, play sports in school, college, and then the 30s hit and they do less and less, you know, and, you know, maybe your social circle diminishes, you might get a mortgage, you might start having a family, do you know, so kind of life changes sort of parallel some of those things that you that are good for kind of keeping your brain volume up. Managing stress is critical for brain health. And I say managing stress. There's, you know, removing stress from your life is not possible and it's not healthy. You need us. We all need a certain amount of stress in our lives. You know, you need the stress response to rise to the challenge. I'm sure, you know, moving to New York, to use that example again, was stressful for you. Learning, you know, starting a new job, etc., was stressful. But that's the response that is allowing you rise to that challenge. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. The cortisol helps you get over that and you know, work through it, and then it becomes kind of easy. So you need that kind of amount of stress. But if you have too much stress and it's poorly managed and it's chronic, that actually prevents the growth of new neurons and connections in your brain. And it shrinks the hippocampus, that part of the brain that I was talking about that's really important for learning and memory. It also shrinks your frontal lobes, which is the important part of your brain for decision making and all those things. And it increases the size of your amygdala, your fear centers. It also interferes with your ability to sleep. And then, if you're not getting enough sleep, one of the chemicals that sort of, you know, when you sleep, cortisol is kind of removed from your system. So if you're not sleeping, then the cortisol is building up. So sleep and stress are really kind of closely linked. So managing stress is critical. Too little stress is really, really bad for your brain as well, because it's your brain is understimulated and you will lose brain volume. Also, you risk boredom, and then boredom can then become depression because you're not being stimulated and challenged. So it really is about finding your own stress sweet spot. It's different for everybody. You know, you might like roller coasters and I might kind of go, no, I don't even do the rollerblades. Do you know?
Yeah.
So it's very individual, but it should be. What's really important for a healthy brain is to keep pushing yourself beyond your comfort zone, because in that you're experiencing new things and you're learning new things, you know, and it's good for growth and development, you know, but you just do it. You can do it at a very sort of, in a gradual way.
Yeah, so
you know, but
really
they're really good. Yeah,
what's good for your heart as well. It's funny how the whole balancing, of course, that comes into your actual health is for your body, but also for your brain as well.
Yeah,
that kind of sleep and stress management and all that good stuff.
Yeah, and I mean the thing is with the heart, like that translates into risk for dementia. Actually, they do. You know, so a lot of heart related metabolic. So poorly managed high blood pressure, midlife obesity, type 2 diabetes, smoking, low levels of physical activity, all increase your risk of developing dementia. So sort of brain health in a way is a kind of a, you know, a sort of a reverse of that, you know, avoiding those things. I'll also say one of my favorite tips for keeping your brain healthy is to smile and laugh as much and as often as you can. Laughter.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's another thing that is at risk from working from home, because a lot of people see smiling as something that they do in response to other people. And similarly, they tend to laugh with other people. So if you are working from home, you've got to make an effort to actually consciously smile. So smiling has huge health benefits. It does help with the growth of new neurons, but it also reduces your blood pressure and it gives your immune system a bit of a boost. And it has just lots of health benefits. You know, it releases feel-good endorphins, you know, feel-good hormones. And the thing is, the science shows that even if you fake a smile, you know, a synthetic smile, you get all those benefits those health benefits. So it really is sort of fake it till you make it. So, you know, smile to yourself as often as possible. I sort of say, start the day with a smile, end the day with a smile. Make sure that you share at least one smile with somebody else, whether it's going on Zoom if you're not outside the house, or smiling at a stranger on the street, because that really spreads the health benefits, because it's very hard not to smile back at something. Of course, we're wearing masks now. That's actually one of my big concerns about masks is, you know, not smiling. And I do fear for little babies growing up now at the moment, because people, I even said to someone the other day, I'm smiling at your baby, you know, because they can't see it. And laughter is nature's natural stress buster. It reduces the level of cortisol in your system. And I think that's sometimes why we laugh in the middle of, you know, scary situations, or at funerals, or things of high stress. You know, we often find laughter. And I think that's kind of our, it's like a pressure valve release, you know, in the brain.
Yeah. So to finish up, your book, 100 Days to a Younger Brain, does that have all of this information in there?
It has, yeah. So it has an entire chapter on sleep, and an entire chapter on how to manage stress, and how to look after your heart, and you know, so being social and all the rest. But what it actually does do is, so everybody's brain is unique. So broadly speaking, you know, different areas of your brain are responsible for different activities, but your brain is shaped by your unique experiences. So no two brains are alike, and no two people's lives are alike. So basically what the book does is allow you to develop your own bespoke brain health plan. So there's lots of questionnaires in it, you know, questions around how you manage stress, or figuring out what your stress triggers are. Similarly with sleep, you know, there's questionnaires trying to figure out, well, what are, might be the barriers to your sleep? What are, what's causing you to wake at night? Or, you know, what do you need to do to improve the quality of your sleep? But basically, you sort of fill out questionnaires, you create your own brain health profile as it is now. And I say, you know, you'll find, like, most people are already doing stuff that's good for their brain. But what this helps you see is where you are at risk and where you have assets. And then you create your own little plan based on reducing your risk and maintaining or increasing your assets for a brain healthy, brain healthy lifestyle. So
it's super interactive in that way. It's kind of almost like a workbook.
Yeah, it really is a workbook, actually, to be honest. So basically, you know, the first couple of chapters sort of introduce you to some scientific concepts like neuroplasticity that I've just talked about here, you know, your brain's ability to grow connections. And then also there's another concept called reserve. And that's about the ability to build up reserves in your brain that you can use then to cope with a challenge, whether that's a disease like dementia in later life, or a disease like multiple sclerosis, or a brain injury, or even just a challenge in life, like or even COVID-19, because a lot of people are experiencing brain fog with COVID-19 even after mild infection. So then it moves into, so the chapter on sleep, you can read about sleep, you can use the book whatever way you want, you know, you can get the info of what's happening in your brain with sleep. You can, or you can just complete the questionnaires and create your profile and work from there. It's very, it's very interactive and very personal. You know, it becomes your
workbook,
your journey.
It's also very interesting, because it's like, you know, I'm all about empathy and understanding where people are coming from. And it really gives that, as you know, as well. It's like, maybe that person didn't get much sleep, or, you know, maybe they're struggling with this part of their memory, or, you know, it's very interesting.
Yeah. And so I think that's important. Like, I really think it's so mad, like, our brain is our most important organ, and most people haven't a clue how it works. They don't even think about it because it works so well. And like, I think as kids, we should be taught how our brain works. And in the book, you know, like, it explains how the stress response happens, and it explains how you know in a way keep making the same stupid mistakes, and it also explains how habits, and how you might break a habit and replace it with a new habit. And that's great, you know, information to have. It's about understanding yourself, because yeah. yourself is really created, you know, by your brain as well. And, you know, if people are interested, you know, I have a podcast as well called Superbrain, and I cover a lot of these topics
yeah.
in it as well. I interview really interesting people about thriving and surviving in life on Mondays, and then on Thursdays I do like a 10-minute about something to do with the brain. So I think last week I did about the teenage brain, you know, explaining what the hell goes on in our brain.
I actually listened to that one, which is very interesting. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's no wonder it's a tough time.
My poor mother.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of tough for you as a teenager as well, because like the world doesn't, it stops making sense in some way. And that's because yeah. some of the connections are no longer there, you know, that you used to.
I know there's a real reason for all these stigmas, you know, like, and all these kind of, you know, staples that we put on teenagers and that. So it's yeah. funny. It's very important to understand the real meaning behind them and the real reasons, you know?
Yeah, I think it helps. I think it makes it easier, you know, rather than, as well as that, like say something like that teenage brain, rather than, you know, a parent thinking their child is just not listening to them, or, you know, not, why do they keep taking risks? Well, the part of their brain that assesses risk actually isn't developed yet. So they actually cannot make that assessment. So you really do need to support them. And actually, if they understood that, it might help, you know, because that's one of the most challenging parts of teenage years, is that you can't assess risk. And so frequently, with often fatal consequences, teenagers take unnecessary risks, you know, with their own lives.
Yeah, I know. It's important to understand. I'm truly passionate about it. I've actually learned, so I've written down little notes about your brain loves patterns, gut feelings are a fear response, staying socially connected is critical for your brain. This is like fascinating. I think it makes for perfect little nuggets as well. So your book is available eSINS and online, I think, as well.
Yeah, it's available online anywhere, and yeah, there's a US edition as well, and it's yeah anywhere you buy books basically. It should be available.